Why 128 years?
126.
How good is your arithmetic? Can you multiply 18 by 7?
Yeah.
What does it come to? Well, it's actually quite logical to have that number, because when you follow the sequence through from the individual to the pair, the group, the superior group, and so on, it adds up to 126. And that adds up, if you look at it carefully, to what?
Wow.
We call that a magical addition. The ninth letter in Hebrew is Tet, and means a serpent, and a magician, and subtlety. Ordinarily, it takes 126 years to think it up. Most people get rather tired and die out of the way of the thought process. You might live that long if you go to the Hunza territory or to Georgia in Russia, because a lot of people live to that age there, and more, up to 150 and so on, for one simple reason. They live what is called a clean life, and they go to bed at sundown and get up at sunset. Or the reverse, according to whether a night duty or not. They live very naturally, it's quite simple. If you live very naturally and you don't wear yourself out in whatever, normally one wears oneself out, then you live a long time. The reason for that is because worries create tensions create inhibited circulation deprives the cells of oxygen and they die. So premature dying can easily be gained by keeping very bad hours, getting overtired, not getting sufficient sleep. If you really want to feel fine, this is very good advice, I wish I had time to take it. Go to bed at sunset and get up at dawn. Just try it for a few weeks. You'll find you actually feel better. Of course, because most people haven't the time in a civilization to do that, quick methods have been invented of arriving at the same conclusions. Those are the methods which in different countries have different names. In Japan you call it Zen. In Kierkegaard you call it second immediacy. Various mystics have said the same thing. If you can persuade yourselves that here and now is the only time worthy of paying attention, when you suffer something, when you undergo something, it is always in the now moment. It never was in the past, it never was in the future, it is always now. But through worry processes, produced, strangely enough, by civilization, the tendency has been to think about past miseries and how to avoid them, to think about future joys and how to attain them, and this has split the mind in two opposite directions, towards the past and towards the future. Now there are tremendous inertias trying to persuade you to think about the past and learn the lesson from the past and then apply it in the future. So the past isn't here and the future isn't here, and while you're thinking about the past and the future, you are failing, and I mean failing, being inefficient, in dealing with the immediately present situation. Now if you deal with the immediately present situation with all the intelligence you have, then the result will be total efficiency in that situation. That is the short way. The short way, in all the schools of philosophy of the ancient world, in all the yoga systems, in all the mystical systems, it is always coming back to now. The only time you ever did anything, no matter how far past it seems to you to be, when you remember it, it is a present now in your mind. So it's this question of presence. Presence is a very peculiar thing. because it contains pre-sense. Look at the word presence, and it's pre-sense. If you are terribly alert now to what is in the now pressing moment, you can actually feel existential tendencies which will produce the future, because they are present now. Whatever the future is, it is the effect of present causes. If you are so busy worrying about the past or the future that you are not sensitive enough to the present causes, then you will have no future under your control. And if you are aware of the immediate situation's causative forces, you are automatically taking care of whatever it would be that you might imagine would be your future. This process that we've outlined very shortly, you have to learn about something, initially with your body, then you have to learn rules of relation, then you have to revolt against those rules, because you are not equipped as a baby to begin with to solve the problem yourself, because you have no sense of presence. You may notice that babies are always looking outwards, and they're always looking for something to do, because the energy in them is far more than they can control. So they come out of their bodies, and they stare at the external world, they try to interfere with it, and they lose presence by so doing. Presence is the most powerful thing there is. Presence in this sense of awareness of now, which is the meaning of this last month here. Presence is the sense of total reality. Now you know that the whole universe is definitely proved, no longer theoretically, proved to be an ocean of energy. And that energy has various levels of activity. When it's most condensed, it makes the solid, the mineral world, represented in your bones. And when it's less condensed, it makes fluids. When it's less condensed, it makes gases. Then it makes magnetic forces. It makes volition. If you use the mnemonic of our hand, physical body is condensed power. Feeling and emotion are condensed power. Mentation is condensed power. Conceptual logologic is condensed power. Volition is condensed power. Observation is condensed power. There isn't anything whatever anywhere other than that power. Now you see in this little outline, going out, looking outside, and hoping to solve a problem by making a relation with an external being, first with one's physical self, because that is external, to the internal consciousness, then with two, then with a small group, then a larger group, and so on. As long as you think that the salvation is on the outside of you, you cannot get to the reality of the inside of you, where presence is. Presence is to do with Easter. You know that Easter means the point of arising. And it's a balance between the lunar festival and the solar festival. The sun has to be in a certain point in the year, and the moon has to be full at the nearest point to that sun point. When these two coincide, you will have the sun energizing and the moon at its full. Now the sun energizing means the energy in your body. And energy you can get in two ways. One is by eating, and the other is by direct giving up of oneself to the infinite field of power. You know, that Jewish sage Jesus said, when the disciples thought he should be hungry, he said, "I have food you know nothing of." He was referring to the ocean of power of which we are modalities. Now we can get that power directly, or we can get it indirectly by eating food. When we eat food, we have to chew the food, we have to digest it, break it down, and reduce it to the finest level of energy, which is then nearly coincident with universal field force. But we have to work very, very hard with food to get it to that level. We have to fight the food. When you eat a carrot, either you or the carrot will win. If the carrot wins, you look like a carrot. If you look like you, you have won the battle. Now, because when you eat, you have to reduce food in this way to the finest possibility of existence, which brings it very, very near to the field power, like a homeopathic medicine does in its high potencies. The other way is by a little simple thing called interest. The rule is, where you are interested, the field of power of the universe is interested. Interest is very interesting because it's spontaneous in the baby and progressively becomes less and less spontaneous as we become more civilized. Civilization is a special device, a brake system, to stop people accelerating their development beyond the social needs of a given historical period. For instance, we are in a chip development period where unemployment is increasing because of the necessities of the situation. At some time in the future, about 3,000 years hence, nobody will work in the sense that people work today. Everything that is done in the work mode that we have today will be done by machinery of various kinds. And the controls will be mostly electronic, and the human race will have something else to do with its time other than toiling. We've got to wait for the generality to reach that level, 3,000 years, which will take us into the middle of Capricorn. We've got 2,000 years of Aquarius to go through to get there. Now, in each century there has been a necessity for a certain kind of work because of the lack of technology to do it. We're in the beginning of a new period. You could slice history in half, if you like, with the appearance of chip technology, because that little device, like a cell in the brain, can be utilized to do all the dirty jobs, all the rough jobs, all the unrewarding jobs, quite simply the press of a button. Women's work, including test tube babies. There won't be any necessity whatever for people to do any of the kind of stuff that's called work today, because the whole of that will be done by technology. And that is the logical development of the improvement of intelligence, which began with the first murderer, namely Cain. Cain itself is a Hebrew word meaning possession, and it was because he felt that he possessed the fruits of his toil on the land that he got annoyed when it was not acceptable as a sacrifice and murdered his brother. Now, because of that, he expected trouble. If you read your Bibles carefully, knowing that they're a handbook of human technology disguised, you will know that Cain said, "Every man's hand will be against me," and he was terrified he would be killed. And God said he would put a mark on Cain, and he would make it that no man should kill Cain without being avenged seven times. Cain then went away and founded a city, the beginning of civilization. Cain is the same thing as canniness. It is the same thing as technology. And the raising of Cain is the raising of technical efficiency to the point where the man who refused to place God first, that is to place infinite intelligence first, and who put himself first, has been progressively educated towards the point where he will, with his own technology, be forced to believe in that unifield of sentient power. Now, interestingly, we're on the edge of that. We've got Einstein, space-time, continuum. We know that matter is only energy. We know that all the forces that there are in the universe are not different fundamentally from the forces of thought, of feeling, and of will. And all forces are interchangeable. That means that your physical body is generated by your emotion. Your emotion is conditioned by your thought. Your thought by your governing concept. And that by selection of the will. And that by a fascination of interest in that hexonic field. So interest is tremendously powerful. And this is the most immediate way of solution of any problem whatever. Where you are interested spontaneously, like a baby is, in something, the moment that that interest sets up, energy from the infinite field flows into you because you're interested. You are, in fact, a point of investigation, posited by that field. Call that field God for shorthand, then you become immediately a particularized expression of a divine power. And where you are interested, that power will supply you with the energy to solve the problem in which you're interested. Interest is spontaneous, and making interest is very hard when it doesn't exist. So one has to cultivate interest. And this means never to do anything whatever without first making yourself interested. Doesn't matter what it is, whether it's washing up, having a baby, buying a motor car, flying a plane, going in the Olympics, whatever it is. If you do it with interest, real interest, then the field force of infinity will energize you to do it. But if you do it complaining, and not wanting to do it, the energy to succeed will not come. It is not possible for a person who is doing a thing under duress against his interest to do that job properly. So the very short way of becoming 1-2-6 is actually to recognize that interest to date has led your life. You have gone from one point to another by interest. And by nothing else. Society, civilizations, have tried to impose upon you interests not proper to you because of the necessity of material survival for the time being in each century. And we are not yet released from the necessity of work. Technology is not yet perfected. And because of the necessity of keeping the drains under the road, and the railways and the roads all working, people have to be imposed upon and given interest not proper to them. Proper means ownness. Proper is simply Latin for ownness. The proprium is the very ownness of a being. The being of that being is its property, its ownness. Civilization, of necessity at a given stage of evolution, has to force people by trickery or violence, roughly equal, to force people to undertake to do things in which they actually have no interest. Today you talk about job satisfaction. That's a phrase trying to persuade people to be interested in their work. Telling them if you can find a job in which a person will be interested, he will do that job more efficiently than if he's not. It's very elementary, but it's taken an awful long time to come to it. But if you know that in a given century, in a given period of time, in a given period of history, like we are in today, there are certain jobs that nobody is interested in, except a few queer fellows who are doing experiments. But nevertheless, those things have to be done. There are men down the sewers at this very moment keeping the things free. There are men on the road mending them. There are men working railways, airplanes, taxis, all kinds of things. And these jobs are necessary for civilization at this stage of evolution. If everybody stopped doing, the whole thing would collapse. Plagues would break out. Disease would remove half the population of the world. So these things have to be done now. So there are certain works that must be done. Works in which naturally we are not interested. But when we know that we cannot do those works efficiently which have to be done, unless we are interested in them, we have a power inside us to be interested in things that would not naturally interest us. We have another kind of interest. The interest in nature is pleasure preference, pain avoidance. The interest of cosmic logic says, if the thing has to be done in this period of history, then logically you can generate interest because it has to be done. That means you can actually become interested in doing things that you don't feel like doing. Like ladies might become interested in bringing up their children when their children are actually showing signs of independence. Or like fathers might feel interested in educating their sons and not merely their daughters, and so on. There are ways in which interest can be stimulated by logic, logologic, cosmic logic. When you realize that the job is going to be done badly if you're not interested, you can deliberately conjure up with the governing concept of the necessity of it, by logic, that interest. And when you get that insight that you can actually deliberately generate interest, then you have arrived at 1, 2, 6. That is to say, 6 + 2 + 1 = 9. You become your own magician. You become your own magnet, you become able to succeed at anything whatever you decide to do, because the power of your interest will be supplied from your initial starting point by infinity, and you will become an instrument of universal intelligence which will supply you with the necessary energy, feelings and data to succeed. That progression has been thought about since before Pythagoras, has been noted, has been commented upon, and has been seen to be a very mysterious progression whereby you retain absolute consistency, like the number 9 retains whatever you do with it. Now this ability of 9, you know, 9 is N-E-I-N in German, 9 means no. In English we spell it with the same letters turned round a bit, but it means the power to say no to a pleasure tendency that is non-profitable in the evolutionary sense, and to say no to a pain refusal. The ability to say no is a tremendous power. It's very interesting that the name of Jesus, in the Hebrew name there, has the first part of the word means yes, and a particular letter in it that terminates means no. So it means the power of saying yes to having to say no. Just before we came on tonight, and before Vera did her work, she was quite sure she hadn't done enough work on it. I think it's very probable that none of us have done enough work on it in its full sense, because it's actually infinite. You can't have enough work on infinity. And therefore, she came on with some degree, like all people in theatre do, in fear and trembling, that she came on, and she did it. Now, at points, she was like not to do it. In fact, at one point, I offered to tear it up and throw it away and forget about it, because that was a ploy on my part. Most important of all is this. The story here offered about the vulnerability of woman. You know the Cook's Hand Salter It's a handle with a T cross below, used by the ancient Egyptians and by the Hindu priesthood for the same thing. It means woman is superior to man. It's a very strange thing. It means the unformed is superior to the formed. Because the T that's hanging from the O, the T means fixation in form, and the O is to remind you of nothing, to remind you of the ability to transcend any form that you can adequately define. The moment you define a form, you limit the consciousness. And the moment you limit the consciousness, you have lost power, unless you remember that infinity provided the interest in the first place. So that the O on the top of the sign signifies infinity. Now it's very hard for the male mind to think that his thinking is inferior to its feeling. And if you look at that Latin word sentire, to feel, it also means to know. But you don't have a knowing that's not based on feeling. If we were not sentient, if we couldn't feel, and by that I mean feel in the sense, haptically, tactilely, like this, if we couldn't do that, we'd have no content at all inside us. Feeling is absolutely basic. And that feeling is just a synonym for field intelligent power. Feeling is a state of self-assessment of infinity. But when it's feeling itself, the moment it starts to feel interested, the interest posits a point. And in positing that point, it crosses it to mark it. And that cross is the letter T. So if you look at the last letter in that Hebrew alphabet, the Tav, or Tau as the Spaniards will say, you see the etymology, it's just simply a cross. The moment you become interested, you go on the cross of your interest. This particular festival is about the crossing of the sun over a certain point in the zodiac, which begins the year, the germination, the power that will eventually produce fruit. In your interest, you will necessarily put yourself on a cross. And if you accept that you have put yourself on a cross, and you stay on that until you've exhausted it, because you put yourself on it, then that infinite power, which is represented by the O, feeds you, and it's your mother power, which is also a father power. It's called a mother because it becomes the substance of otherness, the differentiator. It is called father power because it puts us here. Father, pater, put here, are all forms of the same word. That which put us here is power, intelligent power. In the act of positing each one of us, it made us into individuals, and by encapsulation made apparent substantial differences, and those are signified by the word mother, M, other, substance of otherness. But the substance is only the power, self-encapsulated. So really, God is a father-mother God, or a mother-father God, according to which way you want to read the word. In the Hebrew word, the first part of the word, the first two letters are feminine, and the third one is masculine. So if you imagine an idea, and a field around it, a magnetic field of interest, looking at the idea, that's the first half of that word. And the second half of that word means drive. Go to it. Get an idea. Drive towards it. And you will be supplied with the power to do it. And according to the intensity of your interest, so will be the power supplied. And where you lose interest, you lose power.
Is it what you call induction?
Induction. And logically, yes. Yes. as opposed to deduction.
Yes.
Logically, deduction, you start with the concept and abstract from it its implications. Induction, you start with infinity and then posit the concept.
Yes, in the sense of driving in, already having a field in principle, you then see the field, you relate to the field, you strengthen the field, but that way you have actually driven.
No, the other way around. When you become interested, the field strengthens you.
Yes.
Yeah. See, the male ideation tends to think it the other way around, that man can strengthen the field, but he's actually in a state of grace when he gets an interest. And the grace is the infinite pressing into him.
Yes, I accept
that. That makes it okay if you accept it.
Well,
you see what I mean? There's a peculiar mechanism in the male mind that it listens to a debate, and at the end of it, it pronounces upon it and says, yes, I accept that. Now that makes it okay with God.
Well, in the sounds of my spirit.
Because you.
Or in a sense, how can you accept anything except through your vehicle of the Spirit?
Well, very easily. You know, Jesus said about that, blessed are you who, seeing, have faith, more blessed he who, not having seen, has faith. Now, women have a remarkable power of believing things that they've never seen and never will see in time. Believing in the possibility of a perfectible husband. And that's not the product of individuation. That's the will of the Absolute imposing on women to force them to try to improve men. I'm not joking. It is a universal intelligent power pressing into women to make women pursue men and try to perfect them. And the men have a tremendous resistance to being perfected. And that also is divine will. No. They think they're going their own way towards perfection in their own time. And they don't actually think that the wife knows better about the direction they're to go in. But they do throw her an occasional crumb by pretending to take advice. But as John just exhibited, if you give him 1,000 advices, the one he likes, he pronounced that to be very truly the true advice. Mm-hmm. This has to do with the mechanism of intellect. Remember, your intellect is made of ideas. They are the product of percepts, which build together and make concepts. But as an idea is a form. Now, when you put forms together, they relate according to their formal possibilities. So if I mesh my fingers together like that, the only reason I can mesh them like that is because they are what they are, discrete, separate fingers. I can mesh them mechanically because they are forms. Now, the intellect is no cleverer than that. But because it works, men think the intellect is terrific. The intellect has produced the wheel, fire, lever, concord, shuttle. The intellect has done all those things, and therefore it tends to think that it is clever. And it forgets that it was actually pushed to these very extremes of investigation that produced the results, pushed by a desire, believe it or not, to please some woman. Do you believe it? Have you got the decency, fellas, the honesty to look back and discover your very first attempt to do anything properly was to impress a little girl? Any dissenters? No? No protest. No, it happens to be true. Kierkegaard put it very simply. He said the first duty of a girl is to raise ideality in a man. And her second duty is to be unfaithful to him. Thus leaving him free from her, but still clinging on to the ideality that she raised in him. Now that ideality will take man to the stars, literally. He will build space stations all over the universe. But only because he wants to boast to a girl in Star Trek. And that is a very cunning device of the Absolute. The Absolute itself is pure, intelligent power. Notice that, intelligent power. Two words. We can't avoid it. Sentience, power. But the word power means male. It means power, which means pushman. What about the sentience? It's female. Now we cannot actually do without both terms. With the aid of the term power, translated to energy, science can explain the how of universal reality. But it couldn't get to that power or the explanation unless it was sentient. But funnily enough, it can't actually explain the sentient. Feeling inside gives information of power. You get the sensation of power from effort overcoming resistance. You cannot explain reality without both terms. Science has tried very, very hard to explain everything in terms of energy, and up till comparatively recently thought it had done so. It left out the observer himself, feeling, wanting, desiring to do the experiments that led to the scientific disclosures. If he hadn't had that feeling to drive him to become interested in the experiments, he never put the shuttle into space. But that sentience cannot be defined like you can define a triangle or a square or anything else. Funnily enough, sentience is knowable only to sentient beings themselves. Only a sentient being knows what sentience is. Nobody, whatever, can say what sentience is other than the simple statement, I can't define it, but I've got it. I feel I've got it, and I think you feel you've got it. But no description of it formally can possibly help. Well, that's a formal consideration, isn't it?
It's semi-formal, in the sense that it's a manifestation of that thing that you can express.
Well, the formal manifestation itself is not the actual felt experience, is it?
No.
You cannot verbalize, you cannot define, however hard you try, what feeling is, because feeling is actually infinite, and definition necessarily is finite. All definition falls under the heading intellection. And this is the difference between men and women. Men go about intellectually solving formal problems and hoping that all problems are formal. Since Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, that's been shown not to be so. Women go about trying to avoid the restraints of form and feeling their way through into relationship without tying themselves down by intellective formal definitions. Now these two poles of being are unavoidably present throughout the universe. We cannot get rid of one. A man feels if you kick him, and a woman thinks when she's counting her change. You cannot get rid of the other end of the stick. So we have to come to terms with this in ourselves.
Excuse me. I've got a problem that there won't be anything else to solve, no matter how much you think about it. It doesn't seem to be getting any easier. It seems quite simple when I start explaining it. In the garden, we've got three trees that were planted when they originally moved into the house.
There.
Yes. And one of them's got to go.
It doesn't have to go.
This is why I can't move on this problem. I've got three trees there, and the three horse chestnut trees. And they've grown too large for the garden.
Get a bigger garden. Buy up the next property.
Can I I thought of that, but I just want to do something.
You thought of that?
The problem that I've got now, the problem that's there now.
It's fantastic. It's an entirely female problem disguised as masculine terminology. He's saying he wants to get rid of a tree or two. He wants, but that's feminine. And he's trying to think formally what to do. So he's already thought of buying the next garden, and the next, until he owns the world. And then it won't be too small for the three trees. There, there, and there.
I'm not listening to you because I want to try and keep this thought in your mind.
Now, that's another one of the things. He's not listening because he wants to keep a thought in his mind. And we call that supreme egotism.
I give it up.
No.
Don't give it up. Go to the end of the road.
Right. No.
That makes you somewhat like that one, I think.
What I could do is I could cut one down.
Yeah, or two, or three.
But if I cut that tree down, I'd have to cut it really low down.
Yeah.
And poison the root.
Mm.
Or, that's what I don't want to do, I don't want to do that.
Why do you have to poison the roots?
Because what happens is it just sprouts up every year. Just
and prune it.
No, I've not finished it. I thought about pruning it also.
Yeah.
But I don't want it there.
Have you thought about becoming a millionaire and employing a pruner?
I don't want to move out.
I don't want to move out.
It's all want. That's very feminine.
The house that I've got, I would like to stay there for the time being.
And you like, that's feminine too. Have you got a good masculine, non-felt reason? No, you haven't. You keep going back like a baby does to, I want it.
The garden that I'm working on, I've fitted in certain potting plants in different positions, and now the trees are overpowering the bushes.
I very like them.
Now,
this is marvellous, really, isn't it? The human race wants to sort the place out by eliminating everything it doesn't like.
Now, I've thought about
the trees, and every other plant thought that one up millions of years ago by making millions of seeds and blowing them all over the place. And man is coming, make more seeds. You know what happens if you're not careful? In the middle of the night, chestnuts will grow in your ears. They will avenge themselves. They will. They'll strike back, they always do.
Now, to cut this tree down.
You know, in psychology, there's a thing called the persistence of error. And it was elevated to the dignity of a law by some psychologists who thought it must be a law because everybody does it. They know that they're going up a blind alley, they know there's no profit in it, they know it's stupid, and they go on doing it. And all the time they're doing it, they say, isn't it stupid? I wonder why I carry on doing it. And so it was elevated into a law. But there's another little thing behind it called unfinished business. And that has to do with the raising of Cain. Cain murdered Abel. Now, Abel means that God is his father. It also means a meadow, and also anything that vanishes quickly because it's been murdered. Now, it is the felt side of your being that is able, and the canny side that is Cain. Your intelligence is not quite the same as your intellect. Your intellect chops with Aristotelian type logic, and that logic will kill your feeling. In other words, men continuously kill women. They kill the feminine in their own soul. And then they're committed to go along the road until they discover that it was actually an error to kill feeling. Unfinished business, right? Means that when you start on an intellective investigation, you will go on and on for as many years or centuries or thousands of years until you come to the end of that thought process, whereby you demonstrate to yourself that you should never have left your feeling. And the persistence of error, which is the same law that the psychologists talk about, this persistence is nothing but a mechanical determination to follow a logical thought process to its conclusion. But the conclusion is there right from the beginning. You leave your feeling and use only the intellect, which is a machine, because it manipulates only ideas, and ideas are forms, and forms relate mechanically. The moment you give up your feeling and think that you're thinking about a problem that is not a feeling problem, you're in error. Our friend here has just shown that he wants to do something about three trees. He wants it, that's a feeling. But he disguises it and says, he's trying to think it out. But there's no relation whatever between the mechanics of the intellectual thought process and feeling. So if he studied all the logic in the world and studied all the knowledge accumulated in thousands of years about trees, at the end of it would still be, do I want, that is feel, to take a tree out or not? And all the logic is irrelevant, absolutely. So finally you have to say to yourself, as a mechanical act, I want means I cut down a tree. You don't feel like it.
I don't feel right about putting the tree down.
When you say you don't feel right about it, you're feminine again. As long as you make yourself have a want to decide to cut the tree down, you cannot solve it intellectually. There is no intellectual solution.
The tree's God, though, isn't it? And he wants to cut the tree down, because he's God down.
How true, yeah. And don't worry, he's already made lots of provision for that. The ancients who knew that fact always apologized to the spirit of the tree when they cut it down. And ask you not to come and revenge yourself. Yes, yeah, could do. See,
could I ask you something that's been on my mind to do with feelings and feet?
Feelings and feet?
Yes. Christ, before he used to do the sacrament of Holy Communion by telling us about the bread and the wine, he knelt and put a towel around himself and washed the disciples' feet. Has it anything to do with the service of the woman in every culture?
He had his feet washed by a lady, didn't he? And dried by her hair. Now feet, the word foot, is the same word as pedestal. And it means that on which you stand, that on which you posit something. The washing of the feet symbolizes that you must have a pure intent when you posit something. The foot, the thing that you posit, must be pure, must be unadulterated, must have no ulterior motives. That brings you back to now. Because in the now, you have a very simple question. What am I going to posit now? In that positing, if you're terribly clear about what you're positing, and you don't have a plurality of motives, your feet are clean. It's significant that the particular disciple didn't want to have his feet washed and claimed to be unworthy. But he was really thinking he didn't want to wash anybody else's feet and defending himself. Now this question of washing feet symbolizes this, that in discussion with people, the real purpose of the discussion is to clarify what is worth positing. So if a group of people get together and discuss what is worth thinking about, what is worth feeling about, what is worth putting into existence, and that is the process of washing the feet.
Sorry.
Pardon? Well, if you remember that although the garden that they were put into was the Garden of Eden, Garden of Paradise, the Garden of Perfect Joy for the obedient, a serpent was in the garden as well. Now that word serpent came from an onomatopoeic base, the same as scrape, because of the sound it makes. And it means you have to be terribly alert, and it also means nature. The external situation. The ancient rabbis translated it quite simply, pleasure, motivation is serpent. SSS, sensual self-satisfaction, is the serpent. Now, in the exegesis of the Bible, you have to say, males refer to ideas, and females to the expression, outwardly, of those ideas. Because women naturally are extrovert and immediate and trying to relate to the world. They are feeling beings orientated to the material world, which is why it's called the material world. But men naturally are cogitators. They're always thinking, like Cain was thinking, every man's hand is against me, how shall I defend myself? A simple proposition like every man's hand is against me, how shall I defend myself, led to all the technical inventions that we have seen in history. They're all devices for self-protection. Now the serpent had to get man, the male, out of his cogitation. He was locked in cogitation, and that's why it says it was not good for Adam to be alone, and the woman was taken out of him and prompted outside to bring out his interest in something other than himself. He was also erotic. The rabbis say he had a wife before Eve, and her name was Lilith. Now Lilith is just a polite way of saying autoeroticism. A man on his own, playing inside himself, will never come out, will never develop. And therefore a device had to be fabricated to get him to come out. And this device is woman. That is to say, the interest in the external world that he was not actually operating had to be taken out of him and then act on him from outside. And because that which was taken out was called Eve, which means the development of life, life developmental intention, then Eve's attention was external, and therefore nature, symbolized by the serpent, inviting, being beautiful, beautiful flowers, beautiful fruits, everything that is beautiful, calls the interest into the external world. And then that externalized interest infects the cogitating male intellect. Eve, having listened to external nature, then goes to Adam and persuades him to extrovert also. And then the error was not that they had. The error was that having it, they did not immediately apologize. And it says very clearly that Adam himself hid himself. If he'd have said to God at that moment, you know that fruit you told me not to eat? Well, that woman that you gave me told me to eat, and I was off God and I ate him. What shall I do now? He'd have still been God-orientated on the inside, an internal cogitator, and that would have been all right. He'd have been forgiven. But what he did do was hide and create a condition of guilt and so surround himself with an encapsulation band, which meant in fact that he was alienated from the field, and therefore he was thrown out of that garden. Remember, Eden means don't judge, and paradise means beyond division. In the state in that garden symbolized there was a condition which was not divisive, not separative, and therefore called paradis, beyond division, beyond duality. And there was no judgment of the kind that would be based on external divisions. And therefore it's called Eden, non-judgment. Once he had fallen for the directive from the external world and then followed it by guilt instead of by applying for mercy, he had made himself unfit logically to stay in paradise, which is beyond division. He made the division, therefore he had to leave the garden of non-division. Fear, he says so. He says that Adam was afraid and hid himself. It's his guilt, you see. St. Paul says about that, that this weapon of the devil's chief weapon is the conviction of sin. You think you made an error, or you have done a wicked deed, and therefore you think I am unacceptable to God, to life. And you encapsulate yourself, and instead of saying, okay, life made a mistake, behave like a rotten swine, please forgive, you are infinite, I'm finite, you're wise, I'm stupid, and do you mind forgiving? And then the infinite says, okay, you've remembered me. But if you say, oh, I've sinned so terribly, I can't possibly talk to you anymore, put the covers over.
And that's motivated by wanting to continue to sin, isn't it?
Of course it is. Mm. I've had some wonderfully interesting conversations with men that felt so terrible in their sinfulness, they couldn't possibly hope to be saved, because they had a date to recommit the sin. It's as simple as that. But if you remember that the Eternal forgives you, and it says it very clearly in that book of words, God wipes away your sins for his own sake. Why is that? He's an infinite field, you're an encapsulated modality. If you behave like a halfwit and then don't get forgiven, don't you remain a halfwit in the body of God? Well, that's not very intelligent, but God is intelligent. So no matter how much you sin, he says, when you're ready to repent, let me know. And to help you, I'll flood the earth or set fire to it. Karma, remember karma is made of kama, K-A-M-A, which is the Hindu Cupid, simply means wanting. Pedal-wise, Cupid means sexuality. They put an R in the word, meaning rulership by. It's one thing to enter into a sensual relationship, knowing that that relationship is a play of divine power. It's another thing to sneak up on somebody and try to take advantage of them egotistically. For instance, I was talking to a man the other day who assured me that all his life he had set out to get into a sexual relationship with women, plural, to revenge himself for an injury he had received from a woman. And it was his duty to relate to women and try to get them to fall in love with him, and try to make them excited, and try to make them so that they were looking forward to a wonderful climax, and then suddenly stop, lose interest and go away, and then gloat that they were suffering and in misery. Now the very same act, namely the relationship of power, which is what sexuality is, done as a modality of the play of divine powers, without any of those ridiculous egotistic motives, is the pure divine act itself. In Indian philosophy, that's called the relation of Shiva and Shakti. That is the God of supreme consciousness and the power that goes with that consciousness. We said sentience and power. Yes? Sentience is Shiva. That's interesting. Power, Shakti, is female. Isn't that peculiar? Why is that? That women have all the power and men have all the sense. Men know things and women have got the power. Why do men go looking for women? Because they feel they've got power and they'd like a bit of it, please, to put this idea into operation. Because they can only think unless they get dragged out of themselves by the Eve function. When you see Eve in English, it's two E's with a V between. The E, the fifth letter in the Hebrew, means life. And there's a V in between it, which is the sixth letter, which means drive. So Eve means driving, pushing through time into life. And the life power is doing the pushing. But a man, as such, a mere male, on his own, without an ideal to work for, cannot operate the ideals he gets. He thinks and thinks about wonderful things. They don't go into operation until he gets a woman to whom he can say, I'm doing this for you. Ultimately, the woman is the one woman in the world, because there's only one woman. That woman is Sophia, and she has made millions of bodies to catch millions of men who are locked in themselves by their own internal cogitations. Well, there again, if you take the clock to bits as analysis, synthesis is feminine. Analysis is male, synthesis is female.
I was thinking about it in relation to what Vera said in the play, namely that in the personal relation, the man takes the woman to bits. Like the little boy, he leaves the bits there and departs. Now, you've got to reassemble the thing, haven't you, to get a whole out of it. But how do you go about reassembling the whole when you've got to think the bits of your tendency is to depart?
When you take things to bits, it could be on the gross material level. Like you have to get a knife out and cut the girlfriend down. Yeah? And you haven't the power to synthesize it yet. Chip technology isn't that good. So for the time being, it is not recommended. But emotionally, can you take them to bits? Yeah, you can by having a tantrum. By sulking, by being offish, by being terribly interested in something deliberately that you know she's not interested in. You can play about emotionally and take it to bits in that way. But again, you can't put it back together again. Mentationally, you can take it to bits by entering into a serious discussion of this world's problems, what to do about Poland or Afghanistan. That will take it to bits. Or you can take her governing concept, if she's got one, which of course she hasn't given herself to anyway, and take that to bits. Volitionally you can take it to bits, because actually, although she is power, she's not naturally convergent on her own center. So if you like to be awkward volitionally, you can take it to bits. But you still can't put her back together again. Assembly belongs to that infinite power, that Shakti. In other words, when you're taking her to bits and can't put her together again, all you have to do is apologize and wait a bit and she'll reassemble.
That's the meaning of Humpty Dumpty
on the wall. Yes, exactly. You see, that wall represents the wall of the Garden of Eden. It's called Humpty when he falls out and Dumpty when he falls in. And he's supposed to sit on the wall between eternity and time. But if he falls off, not all the king's horses, king means canny man, came again, the intellect, and all the king's men, that means particularized thought, they can't put him together again. The intellect cannot do it. You synthesize in another way. All the world's great scientists and powerful analysts have never yet solved a problem until they've fallen asleep. And then they feel vaguely in their dreams. And they come up with wonderful solutions from the feminine part of their soul. It's a wonderful thing, you know, the capacity to apologize and mean it and let the thing heal itself. Instead of fiddling about and trying to put it back together again. We wind up by the repetition of the last statement, the serpent told me. Now remember that the serpent signifies serpent, free thinker, offering to you sensual self satisfaction. That's the bait. The triple S, sensual self-satisfaction, is the bait. That bait keeps Cain on the road to more discovery. Because as long as that is his intent, he's bound to be disappointed. And I mean bound, that is tied up, by the definition of the situation. The intellect binds him to go to the end of the road. He wants sensual self-satisfaction. Now supposing he reversed it. SSS, separated, saved for service. He separates himself from the mere pleasure responses and thus saves himself from continuous re-involvement in pleasure-pain experiences and dedicates himself to the service of the field, which brings us back again to this, where anything is worth doing, be interested. If anything has to be done at this period of history, do it. When you are interested, then the intelligent field power is interested in you and will empower you to do it properly.
Then your servant becomes the field servant.
Yes, and then you see that the image of God, the first image of God we know, is a serpent with his tail in his mouth. That's the symbol of reflexivity. When you recognize that the fellow that bit your tail was you. In other words, anything that's happened to us, no matter how bad it might have been, we set up the situation for the self-punishment. And that's back to karma again. Nobody ever did anything on anyone that they didn't bring themselves into the position where they could suffer it. Well, of course, Plato would tell you that in eternity you knew all the answers before you came into time. Remember that the evolutionary theories of the modern world are actually upside down. They pretend that from a material non-sentient matter, from a world that was not conscious, through material complications, consciousness arose and went through various animal phases until finally it reached man. Now that's exactly the opposite. The reality is that the infinite power made a colossal globe, and that globe was called the primal man, the one man. It says about Jesus, he was the son of man, not the son of men, plural. When it's just sons of men in the Bible, it means silly, separative egotists. When it says son of man, it is referring to the cosmic man. The Kabbalah of the Hebrews has the Adam Kadmon. Imagine that the word man means to evaluate. A man is a sentient evaluator. Now imagine that all energy is sentient, and then take the totality of the universe as one whole being, and call that cosmic man. Now that cosmic man is there from the very, very beginning of creation. He is there. He is the creator. He is the created. He is the creating process. And in his infinity, he's uncreated. As to his infinity, he's not created. As to his intention to make a universe, he is created. And that universe is a big sphere which inside continues the process of creating. So there's a non-created infinite and the created sphere, the universe, and the created sphere creates internally. And we are the end products of that creative internalization of cosmic man. Now when that cosmic man wished to educate the man that it made internal to itself, its method was very simple. Take the totality of all the possibilities of actuality of the cosmic man, separate them, and posit them as the mineral, vegetable, animal world, and use those to educate man. So that actually evolution has proceeded in the opposite direction. The cosmic man has evolved progressively right down to the mineral level, going from the cosmic divine, to man, to animal, to plant, to minerality. It's an involutionary process, and nothing can evolve that has not previously involved. So all we have to do is remember that we are modalities, single cells, each one of us, like we have a cell in our body that's like us, with the same genetics. We are cells in that cosmic body of the divine man. And we have the same function to that cosmic man that the cell in our body does. That cell in our body maintains our being, and we have to work by that same divine fiat for the cosmic being, of which we are cells. Once we realize this, not only intellectually, when you see a truth intellectually, the next thing you have to like it. Because it's true. Did you ever think that when you see a truth you have to like it? Or do you find that the pleasure pain level, when you see a truth, you don't like it? I mean, say these degenerations from that top row down here to this. Do you like this creature here before the transformation? Isn't there a tendency not to look forward happily to the progressive degeneration of your body? Isn't there? Why? You're only going back to this state, which is hidden in that state up there. But you're so identified with finitude that you're terrified of becoming infinitely powerful, infinitely intelligent. Why? Because it might tell you not to do something stupid that you're engaged on. Conscience is always telling you not to do things that are not worth doing. But the egotistic being, the empirical egoic being, doesn't like being told the truth. So the rule is, when you see a truth, love it. Because it's true. That's simple. And then, if you love a truth that you've seen, do it. Act on it. And that's all it is. See it to be true, love it because it's true, and then act on it, because you love it because it's true. Now if you do that in every instant now of your life, you can't go wrong. It's impossible to do wrong if you do that. Nor can you regret it. Even if you had to remove a tree from your garden, if you saw truth that those three trees were too near each other and cramping each other's style, it might be an act of mercy to remove one. True? We had a silver birch tree in the garden here, and somebody planted, like a lot of the other trees in this garden, too close to the cedar tree. And that cedar tree could not grow that way at all because of that silver birch. And it was a very malformed cedar like that when we first came. We took down that silver birch, apologizing to it, we actually apologized to it, but pointed out that it was distorting the only cedar tree in the garden there, and there were lots of silver birches, so to the spirit of the silver birches, excuse me, do you mind if you remove one of your representatives? Just to be kind to brother cedar here, who can't grow because of you. And it never kicked back. And the cedar now has a beautiful shape. On the silver birch. See that we moved? We could have done, yeah. But we got lots more like it. They've all been taken from the same eternal silver birch. Like an Indian making a birch bark canoe, you know, he always apologized. And he said, I can't row properly without you, do you mind? And then the tree spirit said, okay, cut me up. Can you believe that that's called the spirit of willing sacrifice? Yeah. And that at the level of intelligent power, sacrifice is a great gain. And that's why the word sacrifice means secret doing. You do something in secret, and it's a sacrifice. But something comes out of it that wouldn't have come out if you hadn't have made the sacrifice. So you can't really make a sacrifice without a spiritual profit.
Yes.